I'm David Grusky, and I want to welcome you to the third lecture in our Sawyer seminar series, a series that's devoted to trying to make sense of the changes in the structure of inequality as we move into the 21st century. Some of them often baffling, and certainly most of them quite spectacular. This series is funded by the Mellon Foundation. It's co-sponsored by the Stanford Center on Ethics and hosted by the Stanford Center for the Study of Poverty and Inequality, a program within the Institute for the Research in the Social Sciences here at Stanford. And it's my great pleasure to introduce here today as our featured speaker, Professor Richard Freeman. He holds the Herbert Asherman Chair in Economics at Harvard University. He's director of the Labor Studies Program at NBER, and is senior research fellow in labor markets at the London School of Economics Center for Economic Performance. If you look over Richard Freeman's career, what I think is most distinctive, most striking, and I don't think this is unusual, is that he's made so many profound, path-breaking, landmark, field-defining contributions in so many fields. So I'm referring to his work on the effects of labor markets, on the effects of immigration and trade on inequality, on basic changes in the structure of labor market institutions, on education and inequality in labor markets, and on and on and on. We all know the very famous foundational work that he's completed in each of these very subfields, and many more as well. And at least, you know, when I went to, say, Economics 101, what I was told is that, you know, there's this fundamental trade-off that what social worlds are all about is the trade-off, opportunity cost. And it seems here what we have instead is a case in which, in this particular case, the laws of opportunity cost seem not to be upheld. They seem to be circumvented. And this fundamental trade-off between quality and quantity just doesn't seem to be realized in the case of Richard Freeman's career. So what we have is, to be sure, prodigious amount of work, but also an extraordinary accomplishment in each and every subfield to which he's contributed. So it's a real honor to have with us here today, Professor Freeman. Thank you.
Friends in the audience. The last time David asked me to give a lecture was at Cornell, and I was the right-wing economist who was going to defend inequality against the sociologists. So this time he is not asking to play that role, but I gather that I am the first economist to speak in the series, and that the others were vaguely Marxian, and I won't be that. Okay, this is the title. I'm going to use the PowerPoint. I'm really eager to hear people's comments and suggestions. This use of the word soul is obviously an interesting use. This is some events that you know about. And so we have Enron. If you're in Italy, you know about the Parmalat disaster. There were scandals in Volkswagen. And I put down here lists of some behavior. Walmart, it turns out, not only have they hired illegals, which we may or may not, how we want to judge that, they've also squeezed suppliers. They play very rough with their suppliers and other people. They're a tough corporation. They're very efficient and they're tough. And we got et cetera. And then I give you the most recent examples we've just had. These CEOs who have some responsibility to bear for what could be, you know, this real financial meltdown of some sort, billions of dollars that their companies lost, they aren't fired. They retire. One guy gets $160 million, and the other guy just got $30 million as special retirement bonuses. So you kind of look at this, and over here it's executives. This is backdating their options, which we'll talk a little bit about in a moment if you don't know what that is. But these are kinds of things you see that and you go, oh my God, this is capitalism. This is not very nice. And then I'll give you, this is from the Australian, Mr. Bond, because this was just a really great statement that I found and some nice pictures, etc. Medical experts procured to testify he was brain dead, and he jailed for $1.2 billion. It's capitalism. Looks bad. And so this is economics reaction. This is my reaction. So you present this to economics graduate students, and they all say, oh, these are horrible. These are horrible people. And I say, you got it wrong. This is exactly what we predict, isn't it? And greed. We can explain the behavior of all of these guys with the simplest possible model. We don't need any extraneous things. Just they saw a lot of money they could grab, and they grabbed it. Now, some of them went over the line and got caught, so they weren't so smart in the grabbing of the money, but it fits with economics. So that's one reaction to this. I said this should be the way economists look upon this. Morally offensive behavior as simply reflects our model. We know some truths about the world that the sociologists may be less likely to look at. And this is my reference to the economics here. You maximize profits, you do this, and the word ethical, I didn't realize it was one of the groups responsible for this lecture series, but ethical doesn't appear there. But then we look at this other part of the capitalist thing, and this is the schizophrenia that's in my mind. Two things. Gates gives away lots of money. Warren Buffett not only gives away his money, gives it to the Gates Foundation. You know, if I'd been his advisor, I would have said, why don't you buy Stanford and call it, you know, Buffett Stanford. With $44 billion, buy Stanford? I don't know, buy Harvard, I'm sure. And, you know, so, but he didn't. He just gave it away, not with his name, etc. It's a fair trade thing. And SAI is a basically business group that puts SAI, we're trying to get them actually to put SAI stickers, which they will vouch things are made under good conditions. And that's Business Ethics is a magazine. So this is also part of the capitalist thing. You can't, these are facts. And I got some more pictures of people doing things in our capitalist system, unions, being solidarity, volunteers. Volunteering in the U.S. is huge, more than most in any other country. And you think volunteering and charity, it's about 2% of GDP, which is pretty big. People just do volunteering. But, I don't know, that's disturbing. You're working for nothing. What's wrong with you in terms of the model? The open source Linux production, these other people just doing good things. And that's also part of our system. So you have these two interesting different parts. And that's the problem. So I said the battle of the soul is these two visions. It's the market and self-interest and greed. Economists, the word greed is considered a good word. I realize the rest of the world, people have a little doubts that greed is considered good. But we mean it operating in your self-interest, you know, doing rationally what benefits you. And then the generosity, solidarity, cooperation. And so that's, the lecture's going to be all about, okay, they're called the battle between these two visions. I think, at least to me, it illuminates a lot of what's going on in economics at a sort of a deep level of different camps and different groups, taking one of the two perspectives, pushing it a certain amount, and then arguing with the other group. And my claim will be there is evidence, this is the schizophrenic part, there's evidence for both sides. I mean, we have Warren Buffett and we have Kenneth Lay. Ken Lay, of course, as you may know, was a PhD in economics. And he's the man responsible for the Enron disaster. I don't know if Warren Buffett took a class in economics. And these are the levels of which I'm going to discuss this very briefly. It's the level of the individual, you yourself making a decision. And then I put the greed self-interest and the cooperative thing, you can see them, etc. The organizational form, the greed self-interest, you set it, you're an entrepreneur, you set up the business, you are responsible, you are the great person for your business. And the other side, teamwork, shared capitalism, we have all employees share in the profits of the company. We have our startup and everybody gets shares, etc., etc., etc. In the markets, pure competition is a model that says we do not want people, we want people to compete against each other. Prisoner's Dilemma is a model where we say we want people to cooperate with each other. Both models exist in the world. And then, not to a degree, it's supposed to produce efficient markets, but we know there are anomalies. And then you can, since I do a lot of study of trade unions, you look at the union as the monopoly that raises the price of labor, and that's all it does. And then the union as the voice of workers, putting some democratic something into the world. And then we'll come down to the end of the economy. I said unfettered markets, they're deregulated. The corrupt state means that the people who take this one particular view, they believe, generally speaking, this governments are corrupt. So the states are corrupt, and therefore you want markets, you don't want to do states at all, and then we have social dialogue in an active state. And that's the vision of this, division of views. I don't want to take, because this is about inequality, let's talk a little bit about this. And this is a little bit of what I said in the Cornell talk years ago. Because inequality to many economists does not mean what it means to sociologists and a lot of other people. You think of it as incentives. And if there's a lot of inequality, that means there are a lot of incentives. Hopefully, that what people do is they change their behavior. And in responding to those incentives, they drive down the inequality. And you get an efficiency. And then if you have that view, we say, if you mess around with markets, you're going to always have an efficiency cost to this, distortion, and so on. And then the alternative is the view a lot of other people hold, not economists, it leads to inequity. You just see the word, you don't say efficiency. You say inequity from this. It's just, in economics lingo, you'd say, well, people got some rents, meaning they didn't need to get that money to do whatever efficient act, produce whatever they did. They got extra rewards, and et cetera, I think. And there the view is you need more cooperation. And then I'm a big fan, not everybody's on this, but this Coase theorem, which says, gee, a lot of distribution things can be separated from a lot of efficiency things. That we shouldn't think that whenever we intervene or do something happens in a market, it necessarily reduces efficiency. The Coase notion is that, yeah, there'll be some side payments and agreements and we'll always try to get to the, if we don't have too many, we have zero transactions, because we'll always end up with an efficient production, and what we'll end up with is maybe is different distribution of that production. There's a whole experimental literature trying to study the Coase thing, and there's some empirical literature. It's very mixed about how powerful it is. That's probably the fairest way to say it. So I said, just say both of you have to grapple with this. Because if you believe that you need all these incentives in inequality, you have to, and you believe that any government interventions are going to necessarily cause inefficiency, you have to say something about why the parties couldn't work out and still get the maximum profit. And then the other side the same kind of. Well, that's the issue. Now, there's one interesting question. I call the interplay among the levels. Some economists, and it sometimes includes me, of course, say, well, I don't care about the psychological stuff. You just give me this competitive market, and then people have to produce for the market. So I have the person, the devil made me do it. And that's what you hear people say. You'll hear people say, globalization made me do it, et cetera. And these zero intelligence agents, there's a set of interesting economics models which just say, we don't need anybody to optimize anything. All we need, and zero intelligence means they just randomly make decisions, but if to stay in business you have to make a profit, the only ones who are going to stay in business are the ones who make what would have been the intelligent decision of an optimizing agent with full information. And so that says, gee, maybe we can study the psychological person, they're different, it doesn't really matter. And that's very, there's evidence that makes some sense in some situations. And then that's a more complicated thing. I haven't got a good sexy picture of the devil made me do it. But then we have a whole set of theories, game theories, and market analysis that say, wait a second, that's not fully right. You can't assume that the market is always going to give you these nice results. And it can change institutions and so on and so on. One of the great examples we now have empirically is this thing of the status quo of savings versus the opt-in savings. If I give people a choice, a lot of people will not, for a long period of time, make the right decision in their own absolute self-interest. In a year or two, maybe they'll wise up, but if you give them the status quo is that your money goes into the savings fund, you stick with it. And that immediately tells us the way you pose the thing, the way you set it up, the market, that's the easiest one to talk about. I won't go too much into these evolutionary game theory experiments, but they clearly show us that what lives in the end is tit for tat, which is nice and retaliatory. And those are markets, prisoner's dilemma type markets, where it pays to cooperate, but it doesn't pay to turn the other cheek. It also doesn't, maybe, it's turn the other cheek the first time, maybe. Hopefully they don't slap you, but if they do, tooth an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, for anybody who wants to do this. And then there's been a whole set of analyses now saying you just need a very small number of people to step forward and punish the people who break the norms. And that will establish a good cooperative solution. And then, of course, there's an issue, why aren't those people free riders? I'm sitting there waiting for you to stand up and do that act. And then I said, there's a lot of information. You need rating agencies. You need people to provide that sorts of information. Then there's two Stanford guys. I really love their theorem, Jonathan Bender and Swiss. I don't know Mr. Swiss. I don't know either of them. And they have a very nice theorem, the game theory theorem, which sort of says, really, once you accept this prisoner's dilemma, matrix of returns, it pays to cooperate, then in fact there really is a good reason to believe that people will in the end, what lives in the long run is being nice and retaliatory. It's a very strong and powerful theorem. And I'd say minimum stabilizing frequency means you just need 50% of people to behave in this way, and it'll never be driven out of the market. Whereas it turns out if you're really a mean, non-trusting person, you have to be 100% in the market. So it's a very strong result. You need about half the people to be okay in the model. So all of this says we've got a whole set of stuff that does tell us you can't just say, oh, the market, trust it, etc. Once you move away from a purely competitive game, you get a more complicated game. And there's a lot of things here. So this is the, I got the two faces, all the great pictures. So this is the dilemma that I have, and I think economics has. Greed versus this generosity, solidarity. We've got theories on both sides. We've got clear empirical examples of horrible greed, and we've got clear empirical examples of generosity and so on. And then some say, well, which vision should I sort of appeal to me, or how should I deal with this? And then I point out, this is not unique to economics. And the physicists have this physics is the ultimate, science. It's the most successful in some deep sense of terms of theories, and they don't know whether light is a particle or a wave. They have some experiments that show it's a wave and some that show it's a particle, and they don't know. So all they can tell you is that under some circumstances the wave properties are observed, and under some circumstances the particle property is observed. And that is that no one understands quantum mechanics. And that's what all the quantum mechanics guys say. There's a famous quote by I forgot who said, if you claim to understand it, you really don't, because you've got to be puzzled by how it operates. And the biologists, there's also an element of, they're working on very similar problems to this. How do you get altruism? Now there's a movement back in some of the biology theory, there's group selection. A group in economics is now an institution, I see that as. So we organize something, maybe that's quite important. And then there's, I never liked this quote, but it just seemed to fit here, because I never liked this particular philosopher. But he said a foolish. So maybe you have to hold the two visions in your head at the same time, the way the physics guys do. And there is the physics problem, where we see the photon, not knowing what it is. And I could see, if I had a great cartoon, it would be you know, some business person, capitalist, and I say, which am I? Bill Gates giving away money, or maybe Bill Gates running Microsoft as an evil monopoly? And they're both there. So that, et cetera. I'm not even sure if I'm a waiver particle. Okay. Now why is this, I think, important? Well, I do think what goes on is that different economists and different people in the broader society have one of these two visions as more important. I assume your Marxist guys here would have been like very neoclassical economists. Everything is greed, and they wouldn't see that capitalism also has a lot of solidarity, generosity, and other things. In that sense, I didn't really hear those lectures. I don't know. Maybe they were much more subtle than I played them out to me. But Marx was a sort of a neoclassical economist in some, or a classical economist, excuse me, in some sense. So I think these things affect a lot of policy stuff. And I hear I called the guys the neoliberal folks. There's a general thing of if you have a view of the markets are almost always efficient, the guys are behaving on greed, but the greed is going to be controlled by markets. You have a fairly conservative, you know, view of stuff. And then if you have this, I call it progressive social democratic thinking, we can't trust business to deal with global warming. We must intervene in various ways. We have to restrict markets because we believe it's the prisoner's dilemma type game and so on. And then I've been greatly concerned in a lot of work between the European model, which is quite different in some respects from the American model of capitalism. Ours is really market-based, and theirs is based on what they call social partners. So you sit around and you talk, the business group talks with the labor group, and you know, if it's Coase theorem, it should be fine. They should reach the optimal solution, and they should divide the thing up depending upon what the rules we gave them are. And you know, I wish we believed the Coase theorem always worked, because that would be very nice. And then I think the same thing occurred between when they were selling, they're no longer selling, the Washington Consensus view of globalization, which was, you know, just trust the markets. First they said prices, all we need are prices, get the prices right, everything's fine. They backed off from that, and now they're in confusion, I think is the right way to phrase it. I call it diversity vision of globalization, which really means nobody's quite sure what's going to work for different countries. There's a lot more emphasis that we better know something about the country. That's a message there. Okay. And then I want to give one more policy relevant thing to this, which is in the labor area. And we labor economists are very proud that at one point the smart guys studying economics went to macro. They didn't go to labor and they didn't go to economic history or something like that. It was always about, oh, you have to be a macro because that's really what the big issues are. There's been a real change in that vision of what economics is about. And now, and since the 1990s view, the OECD pushed a very strong view that all you needed was deregulate some things, and you needed more inequality incentives. And then we now have the behavioral psychology view coming into economics, and so we're in a debate over how do you treat an institution? Is it something that is going to help you cure some market problem, or is it something that's going to redistribute money and cause some inefficiencies? Well, it'll always redistribute. But the question is it redistributing in an inefficient way, et cetera? And that's just, this is a debate that, through area after area, I think give references with quotes, you know, saying, this is what the Washington Consensus guys said, this is what the people who criticized them said. And you just see, they really do have a different theory here. And now I'll make my positive claim on this. And I think a lot of this was based on, they had some theory, and they didn't have good evidence, and then you were able to read into the same data. You and I could disagree, because we had strong priors, and we could always interpret the evidence in a particular way. That's the conclusion thing at the bottom, in the ideology part of this. The other criticism up here, earlier, is, which is striking, we have a very strong economics model. We know when something is wrong, we look for monopolies, we look for inefficiencies, we have some things. The other side of this, in the sense of in the European debate of the social dialogue, nobody's got a good model. The Coase theorem is very minimalist. And I don't think anybody's really moved it much beyond what coast that, you know. Just say, well, the people get them in a room and they'll make the efficient bargain. Well, that's not enough, it looks, I think. And so there is this kind of a difficulty. But ultimately, this was an area where I think ideology could reign supreme, because whatever the evidence was, it was pretty weak. And if you had good priors, you could stick to your views. And that's unfortunate. And today, I give my positive response. I say, we can find answers. Yeah. Because we have data. And we have all these huge data sets, bigger and bigger data sets. And I've forgotten, Caroline told me, there's 25 million observations on some data set you have on your computer, you're not quite sure. She just gathered the data and said, well, at some point, maybe 25 million observations will come handy for something. Which is, it's extraordinary, the data. Here. Let's just make a little comment. The statistics department here is really good on big data things. They are the leading department in the country thinking about dealing with millions of observations of data, which is, so, and that has to help. You don't have to do, and we also have a lot of experiments now. And then I said, we have all these great tools. And now I'll give you some things from the newer. So this debate between the economics, either at the person level, you can do neuroeconomics, you can do brain scans of a person, you can't do that of a whole economy, of course. You can do experiments of markets. You can do all kinds of fancy data mining, computer. I just think that the tools are extraordinary for helping us pin down this kind of disagreement, or whatever you want to phrase it, these two visions. And now I want to say what we've learned. And then I'll sort of stop in the discussion, I think. So this is what I think we have learned. We, at one point, it was a really strong thing in economics that said rational expectations. You couldn't build a model without rational expectations. That has slowly been pushed back, I would say. It's still true that it's very hard to build a model without that assumption, because it's a great little assumption. It closes the model very nicely. But the behavioral economics has really forced a major rethink of how much you get out of that. There's an interesting theoretical problem with markets, which is called it's called a minority gain. Analysis done by physics people. About most of you, I assume, have not heard of what the minority gain is. It just captures the heart of what the problem is in the rational expectations kinds of things. Anybody want to come up here and play the game with me? I need three people to play a game. It'll take 2 minutes. That's all. Just 2 minutes to play the game. Nothing bad will happen to you. Promise. I got one lady. Good. Need two more people. Now play with the game, and then you'll just see instantly this kind of problem
somebody,
that occurs.
But, okay, I'm ignorant, so.
That's all you have to have is 2 feet. That's
okay,
all I need.
Good.
I need,
I'll play your game.
And then give me a third person. So somebody. Are only ladies, whatever it is. Sorry, one more person. Come on. Yeah, David, come on. Yeah, it's very simple.
We need a guy.
And you just capture what. The game is this. In Switzerland, it's called Zigzag Zoom. And what it is you the minority wins. You want to be the opposite of the other two people. And the way they play the game is you either put your foot forward, back in the circle there, or you don't. If you don't, and the other two do, you win. Whatever the prize is, we're not getting that right now. The worst thing is, but you may not care about this, but is basically everybody does exactly the same thing. And now, why this captures expectations at a market is because you're kind of thinking, what should I do? Well, it depends on what the other guys do. There's no real economy there to regulate this. It is strictly a thing of expectations, and there's no rational solution. I mean, you can't write down it. It's an infinite recursion of a problem. Well, it's a little bit. I think about it in terms of career choice. Gee, they just announced there's a shortage of sociologists. Should I and all my friends go into sociology? Well, if we all go in, it's like to flood the market. So should we go in or should we not go in? Which of us should go in? How do we make that decision? then it's, of course, it's on the stock market, the same thing. It's the speculation part of this. This is where rational expectations cannot conceivably help us. It's the extreme version of this. So now I ask you, either I will count, I'll say zigzag zoom, and at zoom, either you put your foot in and you keep it out. Zigzag zoom. You win.
Patriarchy.
She's going. We can play.
Already in another way.
Yeah, that's right.
We were cooperative.
He can play. I mean, the game can be played in multiple. Multiple ways.
Twisty,
what was that?
It just seems like a kind of boring game to be playing a lot of times.
No, that's fine. Everybody will remember the point of what the minority game is. It's guessing so that you're in the minority. What's amazing? The physics guys done all this. It has a Stanford tradition. Brian Arthur. It's his. He first did this as a Santa Fe with Benny and his Mark little bar. It was the minority game in a bar.
El Farol.
And then what happened was these physics guys in Europe actually picked up on this and then began treating it as some statistical mechanics problem. They poured all kinds of simulations, all incredible stuff. The stunning thing, about this is, gee, in the end, it turns out people rarely. End up with all three doing the same thing. And you'd say the closest thing you can get to a rational market clearing is sort of the three, I can only get 2-1. But if we had 100 people, you always get an odd number, so it's 99 people. But you could do, 45 to 44. It turns out it gets pretty close. I'm not a great fan of the rational expectations. After seeing this and seeing what happened, but they built it not on people rationally doing it. You're just making your minds up. You're making up, in some way, she's making it up in a different way. Having seen the past, what happened, maybe next time you decide, you think the other two guys now are going to keep their feet out, you'll put yours in, et cetera, et cetera. Turns out, for reasons that the physics guys don't understand, I don't understand, we get some. So that sort of says, hey, even when the behavioral thing is not right, just the rational expectations, I don't think is right. Somehow or other, people manage to coordinate in some peculiar way. We don't understand. In the simple market, we know the rational can't be right. There is no rational expectation solution. And they get something that's close to market clearing. So that's we've learned that we can have, I think, certain amount of deviations from the rationality, and we still get something that looks, in this setting, pretty good. I said this is the evidence for the very narrow view is somebody says, go to any shopping mall and we don't have to do any experiments. We just say, if it's a dollar over here and it's 50 cents over here, we know where the crowd is going to be in the shopping mall. They'll be buying the 50 cent product, the same product. And then we have evidence, again, against the what I call, it's against the selfish, pure greed kind of person. The prisoner's dilemma games are very clear. The ultimatum game, which I assume everyone knows, so I don't have to say anything about that. If someone wants to say some things. But all these ultimatum game experiments are telling us that people indeed put a great value on fairness. That if anyone doesn't know the ultimatum game without literature? Here. Everybody knows it. Oh, okay. Two. Maybe there's more people who are a little shy. Three. Yeah. Very simple. I could ask people to come off Canada, but I won't. We don't need that efficiency to do that. We don't need that. We just say. So in the hat, I put some money. I put an envelope, and it has two envelopes. One says you get $100. The other one says you get nothing. Two people come up. They stick their hand in the hat. One of them gets the $100, and then we say to them, "Oh, you can only have it if you share some of it with the other person. How much should you share? What's the economically rational thing for you to do of the $100 that you would share to the other person? You're going to give them just enough so they're a little bit better off than they were before, so therefore, but they have to accept your offer. So you go and you say, well, $99.99 for me and 1 penny for you. Well, it never works to do that. First of all, people don't do that. And if you set it up so that the dummy does that, they get rejected immediately. And a certain part of the brain goes off, and now brain scans of people's heads. And they're doing this, and the emotional part, you treated me unfairly. So then we go, we say, well, what are the numbers that work? Well, 50-50, everybody understands, you'll split it into five. 60-40, a pretty good chance. About 40 is about, you can't get too much below 40 during the other person. They've done this with many different societies, with the money amounts to a lot, and they get the same basic conclusion. You can't treat the person, quote, unfairly. And then since they've done the brain scans of this, you go in and say, well, okay, agreed, yes, but there's something else built into us biologically that says that it can't be the whole story. And then I said the framing kind of stuff is Danny Kahneman's kind of psychology things, that whenever I want to raise the rent on the little old lady who rents this apartment for me in Cambridge, I never go to her and say, oh, somebody from the business school just offered me more money for your apartment, so I'm going to raise it to you. Pay it or I'll throw you in the street. I go to her and I said, oh, you know, the heating costs went up this year. It's really bad. I've got to raise the rent by a certain amount. In both cases, you raise the rent by exactly the same amount. One thing, everybody says, that's fair and reasonable and good, because the cost went up. Not good, but you just have to deal with it. The other case, they said, you bastard. You're throwing the little old lady out just because you can get more money from some business school student? Oh my, you're throwing the sociology student out because you get more money from an MBA? You can feel that. And so we now know this fairness is biologically built in. That's really hard evidence. So, you sort of look at this decision thing, and I just don't, you know, you have both pieces there. You just don't know, at least we've got a strong theory or some view, or some views, how we should take it. Oh, this is showing the brain lighting up during the ultimatum game. So I have a picture of that here for showing you. And I've never been able to read these kind of things, the brain lighting up in this part, right, in that part. I don't know if anybody's tried to read these in science. But we'll trust that the guys doing it know what they're doing when they say it's lighting up in an area known for emotions. They must know this. Also, they got very complicated, you know, they got lots of sensors. This fits to the statistic thing I said earlier. There's a lot of information coming out on these computers from these scans, and they have to have really good programs to translate them into which area and what, how, and dot, dot, dot. It's a lot of technical details. In any case, that's the blood flows. And then there's a great article in Science just a few weeks ago, which is they did find some creatures who play the ultimatum game the way the most narrow economists would love to do it. And so the chimpanzees, they found, do not have, you know.
Actually, autistic people also do.
Really? Well, that makes good sense.
In Europe, there's a society called the Society for Post-Autistic Economics, which is a bunch of sort of radical graduate students who are against neoclassical economics, and it's based on that finding.
Most of us aren't autistic, and most of the evidence is we do care about this. But the chimpanzees was great. I actually read carefully the article, and I won't repeat the. I remember, it's very short. The science, the one virtue of science is, boy, the articles are like 3 or 4 pages, and you don't have to go through a whole lot of stuff. You just quickly see what did they do, how did they do it, what did they come out with, and you know, it looked all plausible, sensible, you know, etc. And so the chimpanzees. So you might think, well, that's one of the things that differentiates us from chimpanzees. We have a sense of fairness. They do not. That's kind of interesting. If there are any fundamentalist creationists here, that might appeal to you. I don't know. And here is just the, because you couldn't see there, I just put here the results. You know, this is the, it's just the, I didn't think it came out so you could read it on the other thing. And so here it is, Science. It's October 5 of this year. And it said, people will take account of the interests of others, are sensitive to all these things, that's right. And then they do the ultimatum game, and they say what the results are from that. And then they go ahead and they tell you that in the chimpanzees, we have the true rational maximizers. So I would think the next thing we do is ape economics. And that really helps us grow. Chimpanzee economics. Again, that's a general idea.
Well, you know, somebody just did a study with monkeys, and they found that they did have fairness issues. And this one, they gave the monkeys, I just heard the account on NPR, but I trust them totally. They gave the monkeys, all the monkeys got cucumber slices for doing some performance-related thing, except for one monkey got a grape. It turns out monkeys are just much more interested in grapes. And the other monkeys went wild when the one got a differential reward for the others doing the same thing. And the punchline from the NPR person said, in the ensuing chaos, some of the monkeys donned suits and ties and offered to represent the defrauded monkeys. But it may be more complicated than this one.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, the science is pretty good. It really was in an ultimatum game. They found that they were right. The title just says all that you could say. That's what they found in this game. So in a different setting, in a different game, but that would be very much like people. Those would be, could be just different species of monkey, non-chimpanzees. We don't know, that in that sense. So it may very well be the schizophrenic thing could run through the animal kingdom as well, then in some circumstances, some species. Okay, now I want to go to the second level of my discussion. I can make four levels where I'm looking at this sort of disagreement about society or people or so on. And one of the things that struck me in dealing with companies, I deal with more companies than I ever thought I'd ever deal with in my life. That was business school guys do that, we don't do that. But nowadays, economists do that more and more. Is finding out how they're always changing the incentives. They never seem to have it right. The marginal cost equals marginal benefit. Somehow or other, they never find the right thing, or else something more psychological is going on that people, you put in this reward system, people get used to it. I'm not quite sure why. They're always changing this. We economists have a view that, and it's associated with Sherman Rosen, and he's here also at Stanford and now in Washington, trying to prevent the president from bombing someplace or other, I don't know. They're trying to do good things for us all. There's the tournament models, which you presumably know something about, which says we should all, you set up a prize, and the student who scores the highest on the exam gets the prize, basically. We do that in grading things. And then the question is, and this is when I talked about Cornell a little bit, when he had me as the evil economist, is the tournament models, correctly viewed, both in theory and in practice, they don't say we just keep, inequality keeps growing and growing and growing, that we give more and more to the top guy. A tournament model, it really says, in every tournament I know of, you have to give enough to have the people who are going to lose to Tiger Woods be in the tournament, or else there's no tournament. And you want to give marginal incentives to everybody across the spectrum is generally the best thing to do. How marginal, do you want to give a big bump to the guy who wins and then a second to be, a half, let's say, or three quarters? We don't know that for sure. That has to be analyzed, so on. But there's an optimal level of inequality in these kinds of things. So an organization that sits down and says the CEO should get everything because he or she is responsible for the whole thing, that runs against what economics would tell you. And then I said, well, there's all these principal agent problems. And this is stuff that people know. Europe has a lot of these works councils. The American companies have a lot of these employee involvement committees. I'll give you some evidence in a minute on this stuff. And what is striking is that in the United States, we've had a large growth of group incentive pay. Group incentive means everybody shares in some of the pie. And it's that, now the numbers, I assume the numbers will come on the next slide, but it's 45% of American workers now get paid through some form of group incentive pay. So our businesses are out there and they're saying, no, yes, is the greedy, whatever it is, the guy who tried to grab everything for himself, but a lot of businesses are in the business of saying, no, we share our things, because everybody then has an incentive. And you sort of ask, why would it work if you have a group incentive? The standard answer, the standard problem is what they call the one over N problem. So I'm sitting there and I'm saying, gee, everybody in this group will all share something by producing something. And I say, a lot of other people here, I won't produce anything. And because I'm dividing the thing over N. there's some evidence, I'll give you in a minute, that there's an awful lot of worker co-monitoring. So if nobody's working on this row, somebody's going to say, wait a second, you guys, you're taking money out of our pockets. And that's very consistent with a lot of these experiments that tell us you just need a few people to stand up for the norm, and then it gets everybody to work cooperatively. So this is what we find. So I said, got the right number. The 45% of U.S. workers are paid by this. That's an important thing. Greed, so the businesses and their decisions are sharing a lot of stuff. In this case, it's efficient, I think. It's rationally efficient, probably, for them. And the workers do this co-monitoring. We got a set of studies with 16 different companies, and if we ask workers, do they observe the other worker? And then what do they do when they see the other worker shirking? We don't use the word shirking, but say not working up to the potential or something. And boy, when you're paid a group incentive, people step forward a lot more than otherwise. There's a wonderful set of experiments that you can find on the web by Michael Hiscox of Harvard. He's done, and he may be losing his graduate student. He's a political science guy. They set up a thing where they sell different products on the web under different labor standards conditions. And they've been doing coffee, and they did some things with New York stores. And they're now really trying to go worldwide with SAI. But they may have an SAI label that'll be applied and so on. I say they lose the graduate students. The graduate student did this, found you got a lot more money selling the exact same coffee, having it labeled under good conditions. Now, so what you do is you buy the coffee under good conditions, so you're not lying to anybody. You just remove the label from some of it, and then they auction it off on eBay. If you go to eBay and coffee, you can be involved in this experiment. And Michael's results, Michael and Stu, the problem is I don't know the name of Stu, and Stu maybe soon be leaving to become a rich person, setting up Market Sun eBay that will be selling products guaranteed made under good conditions. Now, you might say that's really good. Because you have a whole country, the whole world. So you need a certain fraction of consumers who say, I'm willing to pay a dollar more for my coffee. And what he's getting is people are willing to pay for, let's say, it might be $8 at Starbucks or something for the pound, whatever kind of coffee. They're willing to pay $10 or $11. Starbucks maybe is $10 or $11 already. I'm not quite sure what the latest Starbucks prices are. So we have that. Then this just came out, it's a few days ago, I got a copy of this. A group of Harvard Business School, or one of them is Harvard Business School, and then one of them is Michigan, and I've got the third one is from. They just did a meta-analysis, 167 studies of do firms that have corporate social responsibility policies and do things. There have been this number of studies. Do they do better or worse than other firms? And so the 27 said yes, Mr. Positive, 2% negative, rest negligible. And of course, in a meta-statistic, that comes out to be really powerful. You don't know, you have no clue what the causality is, but what it does, it tells you that behaving good is not necessarily, the market is not slapping down guys who are behaving responsibly. You can build a better reputation, maybe you could sell your product at a higher price to consumers, maybe the workers feel better, I feel this is a good place to work rather than a place that is squeezing people, that they don't know. And at the bottom, we do know, for a long time we've known, workers willing to take jobs at NGOs and other places, for lower wages. So that also says there's an element of where we clearly care about things beyond the degree. So we know this from studies. Okay, now I want to get to the third level. The third level was markets, and then we get to the whole economy. So you see, it's through all four levels. We absolutely know that when you do labor market institutions, be it government policies or trade unions, they reduce inequality. That's indeed, no one disagrees with that. Conservative guys say, oh, it causes a lot of inefficiency and therefore it's not a good reduction of inequality. And more left-wing guys say, oh, it doesn't do very much to efficiency and therefore it's a good thing to do. So I just said, we don't really have a good answer to that as far as I can tell, because we don't know if the market-generated wage dispersion is mostly efficiency or is mostly rents and luck and things that if you squeezed it, you don't see very much change. So I'm a little bit, if we only knew, Most studies of wage dispersion, every measurable thing we do explains only a small amount. So you're left with this great unobservable, so you fight over the unobservable, et cetera. So then what you can do is you can look at how much inefficiency do we see. Like I said, in most of these, I call them triangles, because in economics they're welfare triangles. Most of them tend to be small. Like I said, minimum wage studies, there's debates over whether they're negative or not. Most studies say they're negative, but most studies come in small licenses. And then we have studies of mandated benefits, where you force employees to do stuff, to put in maternity leave, whatever it is. Again, there's often some small efficiency losses, but they tend not to be gigantic. Employee protection legislation is the same. So there's some inefficiency, but not so great. That would be my reading of that literature. And it's awfully hard to find a killer kind of thing in one of these redistribution things. Where we do find some killers are in the financial markets. And if you were to say, what market would you most like to sort of limit its craziness? It wouldn't be the local Teamsters union or your plumbers who are charging more than the market for the et cetera. It would obviously be the Wall Street guys and the people who are doing their financial stuff. So here I said those are the purest markets, and we find bubbles, manias, fat tails, risking performance. And then I always think of, imagine if the Wall Street Journal probably would be in their editorial page, would be in favor of this. Let's get rid of the Securities Exchange Commission and let Wall Street be completely free. I think anybody, the most conservative economist, I assume, would just say, no. We have a history. We know that we'd see all kinds of things. The whole thing would just be incredibly risky. We have to have some rules, and we have to have outside rules. And that's what we do. We have regulations for this. So in the financial market, which is the most dangerous, yeah, come on.
So can I take issue a little bit?
Sure.
The idea that dispersion of triangles tend to be small. I think that our difficulty is that the best identified studies in economics are things where, it's New Jersey and Pennsylvania and they have different minimum wages, or we raise the minimum wage fit in Texas or something. And those ones, I think, all tend to show pretty small dispersion of triangles, and they're very well identified. On the other hand, the real question that we want to know is, what if we were to say Italy suddenly does not have its labor market institutions at all, which it become, we want it to be transformed in a general equilibrium way to a different Italy minus all of its unusual labor market institutions. And that we have no clear way of getting at. And that's a very different experiment. And
you're a step ahead of
huge distortion.
You're a step ahead of you, because that's right, that's the last thing with the societies. Yeah. Let me even go at the minimum wage things in another two ways. I have exactly the same reaction to that. But the place where I paid most attention to is the British, because it is kind of, they put in the minimum wage. They put it in. I was part of the discussions in Britain of what the level they should put it in should be. And I know what the government was. They were very clear. We do not want to create any observable unemployment. So we're going to put a minimum wage in that's going to be very careful and done. And even the New Jersey, Pennsylvania is just, New Jersey was not putting in a minimum wage that was going to cause, anybody thought, the worst thing all for your government, you want to put this in so you have a lot of beneficiaries out there and no observable losers. You do not want to have suddenly all the ice cream stores in New Jersey clockless because you put such a high minimum wage in. So I think one of the reasons why actually these triangles often are small is because governments are very, maybe exaggerate from the British experience, but I was just incredibly impressed. Like everybody was sitting there saying, okay, let's put it in a bit lower than we think, and then we'll see. If we don't lose anything, you go up a little bit. The British actually have done this reasonably successfully. I mean, this is probably the most successful that we have in the world. So there's another reason why I think these distortions tend to be small. Doesn't mean they can't be small. And then we get to the general equilibrium, which that's the other point as well. Yeah, the measured ones tend to be small. Then the OECD now has moved from, and partly, I said, probably my view was, they didn't understand that this is a political economy thing where nobody wants to cause a disaster. And so you're never going to choose that big, we all know.
Nobody really wants to cause any institutions to change, right?
That's right.
They want it to be everyone's wages is adjusted, and that's the only thing that happens. but they don't want to change all kinds of firms and the way they organize labor.
Absolutely right. Absolutely. These are marginal
capital labor substitutions.
This is marginal adjustments being done by governments, either labor or left or right, that are relatively conservative, only because you don't want to risk a disaster. You just, it's not what you want to have happen. And so these, I think it's correct, they tend to be small. They tend to be small for the reasons we agree about. I think the missing part of all that is all of those decisions are endogenous. New Jersey did not make its decision to raise its minimum wage a small amount. So they made it thinking it wouldn't have too bad an effect, thinking it would benefit more people than it would harm, and therefore be a good thing. And you know, New Jersey seemed to have chosen reasonably well in that sense, as the British did seem to have. Okay, now I want to get to your last, which is the whole economy wide stuff, which is obviously the toughest of all this. So I called these AA for Anglo-American economies. So the U.S., Britain is a little more toward the social dialogue system, but still there's a real sharp difference between the British, the Americans, the Australians, all the English-speaking guys behave compared to the way the Europeans, the Europeans behave. So first I said, I've been struggling with how do you understand the social dialogue model? How do you understand these European models? There isn't any theory. I mean, I'd like to say, you sociologists and political scientists, you should be providing the theory. If you go through game theory things where people try to do this, nothing overwhelming comes out. Straight. Because people have, it's not that economists who are doing theory at least don't appreciate that there's a problem. But I went through a painful summer of reading all this literature. There's a lot of econometric things on it. And you just couldn't come out with a single simple story that was there. And I said, here, what you really want to know is what's the conditions for efficient bargaining. And we don't really know. The Coase thing says there should be efficient bargaining if there's no transaction cost. That isn't really true. It's not untrue. But it's often like a market. You know, markets are not fully efficient, but they're often close to efficient, but sometimes they screw up. And so it's very similar, but they haven't got those studies. Then I'm very dubious of a lot of the claims made in this particular debate at the economy-wide. And if I took Carolyn's point of view, it would be none of this is a real good experiment. You don't get countries doing giant jumps. And so here I just reviewed the literature. In the 1970s, Jeff Sachs and Michael Bruno had a very famous book on. They said centralized bargaining was best. Well, why? It's because the Norwegians and the Swedes did better in response to that oil shock than we did. Look, less clear they did so well. But you know, you could make the case. It was not like a crazy case to make. But of course, you don't have, that's one example. 1980s, Kalmfors and Driffeld offered this notion that said, the very centralized decision-making and very decentralized decision-making works very well. That's because the Americans now are doing well, and so too are the Nordic guys. And that was true in that period. But at the same point, a lot of people saw Japan as this great success. And when Clinton first got in, they were touting the German model, the Rhineland model. And I talked to Bob Reich, who said, we've got to put in German apprenticeship systems into America, because that'll help defeat inequality and do all this stuff. And I kept thinking, oh my God, it's not an institution you can move from Germany to the U.S. It's just, you don't know what you're talking about. And of course, they ended up not doing things, but that showed they were looking overseas. And they were saying, what works best there? And now the 1990s evidence tells us that this double hump, that the worst thing to do is to be in the middle of this distribution of centralization. You can be very centralized or very decentralized. That 1990s, the evidence has just disappeared on that. And we still see the U.S. is very good, but now we've got Denmark, Ireland, and Holland, small European countries that are more or less in the middle of this distribution in terms of, they're not the Nordic countries. They're also doing very well. I just think we do have limited data, and you get, it's a historical description of who is doing better in this particular period of time, and you don't really know, it's very hard to make any generalization in my view. So if you could do the Italy experiment, you can't do that. So you're making some general, Italy, when was Italy doing? They were the great miracle country in the 60s and 70s. What's his name? Putnam wrote his book on the early thing. So you know, you would generalize from the period of time when they did well, and it's just description. It really isn't a thing. So this is the place where I'm the least concerned. Now I just point out the U.S. and the EU. There are measurable differences. So we are talking about differences. I gave here the Economic Freedom Index for the Fraser Index, which is, people don't know, the Fraser Index is produced, it's blessed by Milton Friedman, so it's got to be appropriate. It's put out by the Fraser Institute in Canada, and they're competing with the Heritage Foundation and the Wall Street Journal, and they are better. The Fraser Institute is better index. Trust me, they do a better job. And then there's a labor index. And it's obviously here the high numbers mean, closer to one numbers are good. Those are considered more market friendly. So the U.S. beats out Europe, more and more market friendly. Our labor market, more market friendly, meaning less institutions. The government of GDP gave you some other just a set of things. There clearly is some difference in these way these capitalist systems operate. So we can say the different ways of dealing with capitalist stuff. And then how well does the U.S. work? Well, these are all the great things we have for our country. And I'll sort of move to conclusion. And then the real interesting thing is to see at the bottom. I was blown away by it. The U.S. has had reasonably successful in some areas. I call it ballyhoo here. And I've listed the successes. You'll hear that about our country all the time. You hear a lot of that in Europe all the time. America's done really well on this. You're absolutely right. And then what they don't point out is, look at China. We have the absolute gap between America and China GDP per capita, measured crumbly with purchasing power parity, has grown. Because we are so much wealthier than China that our 1.9% growth rate over this period produced a bigger increase in our well-being than the 8.9% China. So there's a lot of the stuff where you measure things in relative terms, and I just said, gee, well, gosh, there's something else going on here. And then this is our success, and then the skeletons, the dancing skeletons in the closet. And this, everybody agrees, this is your point of view. David's kind of stuff. Yeah, we are the most unequal country in the advanced world. Every piece of data that we have says that. I took this from the CIA World Factbook. I didn't realize that the president regards the CIA as a Al-Qaeda front and doesn't want to listen to their things, but I figured that was a good conservative place to get the data from. And so we stand 84th of the 118 countries. What stunned me in the U.S. inequality is we are about the middle of the poor countries in terms of inequality. So we're really very, very high there.
Is that based on income?
This income, yeah. But you can do other measures. I did the CIA one just because I thought that would be a good conservative thing. You'd say, well, this is not producing. The UN has measures, you know. And then this is just facts, but I think economists, we know this. Productivity growth has gone largely the highest pay. Everybody agrees on that. We disagree on the causes or the consequences. We have declining unionism, and we've got no alternative institutions to give workers some say at the workplace, and the workers feel badly about that. We have a high imprisonment rate, and then one thing which I don't think has been widely publicized, you go back 20 years, the U.S. was leading the world in terms of higher education for young people, university grads. Now, I said loss, I think we're now like in the middle of the OECD pack, meaning all the other countries have caught up with us. The stun to me was that Sweden now produces more PhDs per, whatever the 30-year-old, whatever the bottom of the thing was, than the U.S. And of course, the Swedish professors have very narrow wage distribution. And what's going on is they're compensating with totally free education, support for you as a student, and some other things. And so we've had some, I say, problems. I mean, there's skeletons in the closet here. And then I quote Mr. XXX, and who will guess who Mr. XXX is?